Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Jason Corthell, fourth generation firefighter with 17 years of combination experience, 2024 Texas Fire Chiefs Excellence and Fire Instructor of the Year winner, Division Chief of Training along with Wellness and Fitness Director for Cypress Creek Fire Department in Texas, creator and founder for Ironclad Wellness that provides mentoring, coaching, and peer support to first responders struggling with their own mental health. Jason certainly did not have to come on the podcast and openly discuss his own struggles, but I applaud him for doing so because in this day and age, we need more individuals like him to openly discuss their own battles, which in return can show others out there who may be hiding in plain sight that help is out there and they're not alone. I truly hope the listeners can listen and pick up the nuggets Jason drops within this episode. I can't thank Jason enough for coming on and talking shop. With that, I present Mr. Jason Corthell.
My name's Jason Corthell. I'm a division chief of training. I've been in the fire service for almost 17 years now. And I started by watching my dad and grandpa through the ranks. And I just remember walking into the firehouse and always smelling the smell of smoke, you know, fresh off of a structure fire, and it being intoxicating even as a small child. And so anytime I get to walk in the bay and still smell that smell, it always takes me back to when I was a little one and my dad or grandpa would bring me up to the station.
Okay. So with your dad and grandpa being in it, it was pretty much written like, this is the path that you want to go down.
Yeah, I had a brief stint where I wanted to play college football. That was a big thing. Like most, you know, high school football players, they want to go into college. I had some pretty bad knee injuries and shoulder injuries along the way, and just didn't work out. Wasn't in the stars, and I sat my dad down one day and told him what I wanted to do. And of course he was super supportive. And, I moved down. I moved from Oregon to Texas, and, I came down here and I just made a life for myself down here in the fire service.
Okay. And if you can you explain a little bit about your journey getting your feet into the door of the fire service?
Yeah. So I moved to Texas in, what was that? 2000, right around 2000. And, I went to a year of high school down here. My mom lived down here. My dad lived up in Oregon. And, I went to a year of high school here. My dad was a football coach. And so I moved back up there among being a firefighter as well and played for him for 3 years. And then I came back down here, and right down the street, there was a fire station, and I had kept really close with some of the guys in my neighborhood that I went to high school with, and they were all part of the volunteer fire department. And I was like, that's what I want to do too. And so when I moved back down, we all went through fire school together. We joined the volunteer department down the street as cadets, just fresh off the street, you know, 18-year-old kids, didn't know anything, didn't know what we were doing for the most part. And it's been a blast ever since. I'm actually back at my department that I started with. So everything kind of came full circle. I've known all these guys I work with now full-time. I've known them all for 20 years, you know, and it's special.
Okay. So upon actually getting your feet wet and getting into the fire service, was it everything that you thought it would be?
Yeah. And more and more for sure. You know, I think when you're new, there's a lot of white knuckling going on, you know. Mm-hmm. you're on a roller coaster and you're not getting off, you know. It's just one of those things like, yeah, we're doing this, you know. Like I can't bail off this truck. I can't bail on my guys. I can't, you know, I can't get off the ride. And I think a lot of times young firefighters experience that, but it's good. It's in a sense, it's no pun intended, but trial by fire, right? And I knew that there was some cleaning involved as a rookie. I knew that there was some, there was some, I don't want to say hazing. There was some initiation going on and all that stuff. And I'm happy that, I consider myself one of the last that got to experience a true, old-fashioned captain and upbringing in the fire service.
All right. And you are currently a division chief with Cypress Creek Fire Department. So for those that don't know, including myself, can you tell us a little bit about the department, the size, stations, personnel, things of that nature?
Yeah, so we're about 150 personnel department. We cover 33 square miles, which seems small, but it's extremely dense in population because we're right next to Houston. And actually, one of our mutual aid companies are Houston. And we're a combination department. We have a very, very small contingent of volunteers still. Like one or two maybe.
Oh.
And we have a lot of what we consider full-time hourly personnel, which is part-time to other folks, that work in surrounding departments as well. And then we have obviously our full-time. So we have five stations. We have a ladder truck, we have a rescue truck, we have obviously pumpers, first out pumpers, and our crew sizes are generally four. We try to ride four to a truck, but our minimums are three, and those all the time those three for the most part are all career firefighters as well. So we supplement one seat with part-timer.
Okay. All right. And as far as the EMS side, are you guys ALS, BLS? Do you do transport, non-transport?
Yeah, so we're actually just first responders in that sense. We're all EMTs. Some of us are paramedics, but we don't have our own ambulance service that runs out of our stations. We do have a close relationship with them, and they do have some ambulances in the firehouses, but we're totally separate entities. So we'll run EMS calls, but we don't transport. We don't do anything like that.
Okay. All
Last
right.
of a dying breed.
And as far as if a first due structural box were to come in within the Cypress Creek limits, what's your first alarm assignment consist of?
Yeah, so we'll send four stations to that. We'll leave one of our stations in service. We'll call for mutual aid. Like I said, we're densely packed, so our mutual aid is sometimes closer than our third in apparatus. So I mean, we're landlocked in that sense. We're sending three pumpers. We're sending our ladder truck, a rescue truck, and then another pumper from mutual aid company.
Okay. All
And we
right.
have something called a light structure. And
Okay.
we've been running light structures. I don't know if you're familiar with that term
I
or
am
not.
not. So
So
I've, yeah, explain.
light structures generally get dispatched when the initial call taker has a term that's used that's maybe like smoke in the residence, but it's one caller and they don't see any flames and just kind of like it might be a structure fire, that one of those things, and so we'll get a light structure and we'll get two pumpers on the road for that and a district chief. And then usually it'll get upgraded. Usually the caller will say something that'll tip it all the way over into a structure fire, but sometimes it stays a light structure and they show up and it's an air handler or something, or a controlled burn or something of that sorts.
Oh, okay. I mean, I personally, I kind of like that because I know like there are some departments that I know of where if the caller calls and says I have a smell of smoke, that's like a full structural box and they're dumping everything on there until proven otherwise. But I mean, I guess in your sense it probably saves resources from getting out on the road unless it actually needs to be. So I
Yeah,
totally get it.
100%.
Okay. And about roughly what's your call volume?
We run right about 11, I would say 11,000 calls a year.
Okay.
Pretty good amount.
Okay.
Yeah, mostly EMS. like I said, I mean, we don't transport, but we make the runs with EMS.
Right,
So
right.
we're running pretty steadily over here.
Okay. So my next question for you, so once you got on Cypress Creek, and I'm sure you started as a volunteer, when did you transition over to like a paid status, whether it was part-time or full-time? Like what led up to that?
So I came in as a volunteer. I kind of did things backwards. It's an interesting path that I took. I came in as a volunteer. I realized I wanted to do this full time, so I knew I had to go to a fire school and get beyond the cadet training that my volunteer organization provided, which was great. It just wasn't a career style type of training. And so I went through fire school. And I graduated fire school, and my next step was to go to EMT school. And instead, I went to the Marine Corps. So that was kind of backwards. But I went to the Marine Corps. I got EMT certified while I was in the Marine Corps, which was pretty crazy. It was a 3 week course.
Wow.
it was every day, balls to the wall. You took a exam every single day that you had class. What was it, Monday through Saturday? So it was quick. But I passed my EMT, I got out, and I missed the fire service so much. I would sit on my computer and just watch fire trucks responding like a little kid, like just pull up on YouTube, different organizations and different fire departments responding. And so I knew when I got out what I wanted to go back to. And I had had my certifications and everything like that. And so when I got out, I called my dad and I said, "Hey, I don't know if I want to come back to Oregon and be a firefighter up there, with you, or if I want to go to Texas and be back with my guys at Cypress Creek." And he said, "As difficult as it is, I want you up here with me. But between the economy and the job opportunities up here, it's not going to work out for you as well as it would in Texas." So I said, "Okay." And so my wife and I, with 2 kids at the time, we moved to Texas, and I worked as a dispatcher for a few months just to make ends meet straight out of the Marine Corps. And one of my buddies, who was a full-time firefighter at Pearland, Jack Johnson, not Jacob Johnson, called me and said, "Hey, we have 2 positions open, and we need to fill 2 spots." And so I put in for it, and I ended up getting one of the 2 spots, which was pretty crazy. But that I really felt like I had made it at that point. Because as a part-time dispatcher, you're not getting benefits, your
Right.
hours suck. It brought a whole new respect and a whole new light to what they do. I only did it for a few months, thank God. But when you hit the career department, it's like, man, you get benefits, you get retirement, you get all these things as a kid you don't even think about, but now you have a family and you're just like, damn, like I'm really providing now. And it's a good feeling for sure.
You mentioned that you're a dispatcher, and firemen like to critique on certain things that they may know or not, know about per se.
Sure.
But dispatchers also, it's not just the first responders that have it hard. The dispatchers are they're the call takers. They're the ones that are listening to the incident unfold as they dispatch units. So with you having a short time in that field, can you kind of explain just that way people can hear from you being a dispatcher? Like dispatchers have it hard too,
Yeah.
and we tend to kind of forget that sometimes.
Yeah, and I still tell my guys to this day, dispatchers are only good as their callers, and someone's freaking out on the other end of the line trying to extract information from them can prove really difficult. So in that sense, yeah, it is difficult, and I've got to present some of my mental wellness material at dispatching conferences. So I was at TENA, which is Tennessee Emergency Number Association. I was at their annual conference by Nashville. And I was speaking to another lady who came up to me, and she's like, I really appreciate you taking time to talk about dispatchers and the mental wellness side of things. And I kind of asked her, how she's doing. And she's like, I got into dispatching and I love my job, but it kills me to listen to somebody struggling or somebody's last, words or somebody's last actions on the phone. And then I have to hang up and I have no idea, what happened. And she's like, I got into dispatching to help people, but I feel helpless almost daily, in what I'm doing. And I'm like, man, that's deep. That's rough. So, yeah, those folks are right along with us. I try to include them in everything I do on the mental wellness front. And it's well deserved, them and EMS.
Definitely. Okay. So upon getting on Pearland, I've had Chief Jacob Johnson on here, and phenomenal, phenomenal man. I love what Pearland's doing. So can you describe to the listeners, upon entering Pearland, did you seek after individuals that you kind of wanted to emulate yourself as a firefighter?
I would say the Marine Corps taught me a lot, obviously. But a lot about leadership. A lot of leadership books are written from the military, and a lot of those lessons learned and applied in the fire service come from the military. And so I got lucky in that sense that I got to learn from some of the best leaders in the country. Some of these officers and majors and captains that I got to have direct relationship with. And so I took advantage of that. And so I say all that to say, I think I learned from every single one of my leaders. I learned what not to do and I learned what to do. And I think that's important. And your entire podcast, Student of the Game, it's important to be a student and be a good learner, because that allows you to be a good teacher, right? And when you're a good learner, you start, having the ability to extract information and extract it and process it and then put it in the right file to use later on down the road. And so I would say, if Jacob and I, Jacob was my lieutenant for quite some time, and I was his driver, and we loved each other. I mean, we still do, but it was just one of those relationships where, him and I, we didn't have to talk, we just knew. And those are rare in the fire service, but I think when you speak to anybody who has tenure, you know exactly what I'm talking about, and we were just always on the same page. We always knew what each other's needs were. And I had told him that I don't even want to promote. The lieutenant spot opened up in Pearland, and I said, man, I just want to keep driving you. Like, I'm comfortable. And he's like, you need to leave. You need to promote. Like, I want you here, but you need to promote. And so if there was, one person, Jacob is obviously a top choice. I have a few others that have led me extremely well. The entire chief staff that I work with now, all those guys, they obviously have flaws. We're like brothers. We fight, constantly, but at the end of the day, we love each other. And some of their leadership traits and leadership qualities are extremely admirable too. So, just because you're a division chief or a district chief, it doesn't mean that you can't still want to emulate your supervisors, for sure. I think it's humbling.
I like that you mentioned, just here shortly ago, you mentioned that you wanted to stay at your position because you were good at it, you were comfortable, you had a great crew going. And I can definitely say not every firefighter nowadays gets to experience that. Like there are some that are fortunate where they have an awesome crew, and sometimes those individuals will potentially pass up promotions just to stay together. So my question to you is, what would be your advice for anybody out there that, let's say that they're a driver or they're a firefighter, whatever position that they are, and there's opportunity to promote? You always hear you should take it for experience or whatever the case may be, but there are firemen out there that will say, if you're good in that position, stay in that position. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. So what's your advice on that?
Well, I always tell people, there's a lot of times folks will come into my office or someone will ask me, a similar question and say, why isn't that, that person's a slug, that person's lazy, they're not promoting and whatnot. But we have to have those people. We have to have senior, what we call pipe men, right? Like we have to have senior drivers. We have to have senior captains. We have to have people that want to stay in the position that are good at their jobs because those are the ones that I want teaching the next ones, And so bringing that, to the forefront and shedding light on that is important to me. I was kind of in a peculiar situation. I was going through a divorce when I promoted. I had three small kids at the time. And for me, unfortunately, it was a financial decision. And I think everyone's circumstance is a little bit different, right? And I knew I could do the job of lieutenant. It wasn't a matter of if I could or not, but I enjoyed being a driver. That was my spot, And I think, it's kind of like it's kind of like the Ninja Turtles, right? Everyone has their favorite Ninja Turtle. Well, my favorite Ninja Turtle was driving the truck. It wasn't in the back, it wasn't as a captain, it was that, second in charge on the truck. And so, that being said, I tell people if you have the means, okay, and not to dive off into their finances and personal relationships, but if you have the means to stay in that position and you don't have any other obligation or any other worry, that's going to inhibit promotion in the future, then stay where you're at. Stay where you're at. I don't have a problem with that, and it ties back to what I said originally. We have to have people that stay where they're at. I've promoted and I've done well. I've done well, I think, humbly in most of the positions that I've acquired. Now, if someone told me that I could make the salary I make right now and drive a fire truck, hell yeah, I would do it. I mean, I get to pull the truck out every once in a while when I teach at the college and I'm like a kid in a candy store and it's like 10 feet. And I just love it, man. I love it.
I love the answer, and because I have one of my notions is to me the best role in a company is the driver's position. And I know I get a lot of slack from it. People be like, nope, it's company officer, whatever the case may be. But I truly believe the driving position is the most important role in on any fire apparatus, whether it's
I
an
agree.
engine or a ladder. Like, the driver's got to know what he's doing. He's got to know where he's going. And after a while, you should be able to, like you said, you had that relationship with Chief Johnson where whatever he needed, it was he turned around, boom, here it is. Like, it's right there. Like, to me, when you don't have to communicate, that's when you know you got everything going right.
Yeah, that's right. And being in that driver position, it was hard for me to learn. And it should be hard for someone to learn. Chief Johnson was extremely hard on me. There was a point, and it's a little bit shameful admitting this, but there was a point where I didn't understand the direct correlation between GPM and PSI. This was before I was a driver. And I had already had aspirations to be his driver. And he was the first person in the fire service I ever told that. Everyone's like, oh man, you're a great driver. You're a great driver. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, I don't even know the difference between GPM and PSI. I don't understand the correlation. And I told him that. And from that day forward, I think he saw how honest I was in my bringing that up to him. And he was like, is there anything else that you don't know that you haven't told anybody? And I just unloaded. And it wasn't a whole lot of crazy stuff, but the biggest thing was the PSI GPM. And so he worked my ass off. He had me under the truck counting grease ports on the chassis. He had me doing pump calculations on the whiteboard every morning. And I got to the point where, I was probably one of the best drivers because of him, not because of anything I did. And so the fact that it took so much work for me to get that position, I think that that's why I held it in such high regard, is because it was hard to get to that position for me personally.
I 100% love the fact that you are very transparent on that, because I'd like to say I think that there are more Jason Cortells out there, meaning there are different individuals in different roles that don't know something that they feel like maybe it's an embarrassment, and they go
Right.
throughout their term or their position not wanting to let people know that. And like the way I look at it is we can't know it all. Like there are some things that I didn't know on certain topics, especially when it comes to pumps. Like there's lots of stuff to learn with pumps, like lots of information.
Right.
And so I would seek out what I'm going to say here is very important. Seek out the person that you know won't go right behind your back and go, "Hey, guess what? Such and such didn't know this." Like,
Yeah.
find the individual that's going to go, "Okay, yeah, I'll show it to you." Because I have a, the way my mind works, I doubt myself a lot. You know, like I
Yeah.
know it, but then my subconscious is like, "Do you really know it?" And then it gives me that hesitant, just like when I take tests. I'm a bad test taker on myself because I second guess. I'll put an answer down and then I'll change it. And then it would be I had the right answer and I just made it the wrong answer.
Sure.
So I 100% get where you're coming from.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely.
So with you moving up through the ranks with Chief Johnson telling you, "Hey, I think you should promote," was division chief on the radar at all, or how did that happen? Because most people, you know, want to promote, but like they usually don't like say, "Yeah, I want to be a chief or a division chief," or
Yeah.
you know. So, like,
No
how
one
did
says they want to be a chief, right?
right.
I still have trouble with wanting to be a chief some days. No, I mean, I like I said, I love what I do. I'm the training division chief, and training to me is just, I mean, paramount. And listening to your past episodes, I know it is for you too. And that's what this whole premise is based off of, I'm assuming. A divorce and a lot of life struggles at the time. And I was approached to make a lateral move from Pearland to Cypress Creek Fire Department. At the time, I was working full time at Pearland, and I had transitioned from volunteer to part time at Cypress Creek. And so on my off days at Pearland, I would work Cypress Creek. And I knew that they were about to hire three captains per shift and three district chiefs. And so I was interested, but I knew that if I took the captain's position at Cypress Creek, it would be a lateral move, and I would essentially lose my part-time job because I'd be full-time over there now, and Pearland would be gone. But I was willing to take that risk, and I was willing to go look for another part-time fire job for my days off. And I did that, and I couldn't make the captain's test, and so the training chief at the time came to me and said, "Look, if you want to take the district chief test, which is harder, and you pass that, then we can apply it to your captain's process." And I said, "Okay, that's fine." I mean, it sounded a little, wonky to me, but yeah, whatever. And so I sat down for the district chief test. Our district chiefs are battalion chiefs, essentially. Just for reference. And I sat down for the test. I did really well on the test. I came out number two or number three on the district chief test, and they were hiring three. And so I got a call from the training chief, and he's like, "Hey, have you ever considered maybe being a district chief?" And I had just come from a company officer role in Pearland. And I said, "No." I said, "Not really. Not something that was on my radar. I don't think I'm quite ready to get off the truck yet." And so I stewed it over a little bit. I talked to my dad for a long time about it, talked to Jacob about it, a lot of people I talked to about it. And I came to the consensus that I would go through with the process and see what came of it. And so I went through the interview and all that good stuff, and they were still hounding me about district chief. And again, seeing the pay from a company officer to a district chief, that's kind of what put the light bulb in my head. Like, man, like I got three small kids. I'm a single dad. I'm trying to make ends meet. I'm willing to sacrifice getting off the truck for my little ones. Clearly, I'm good to go for the job. I've come out pretty well on this process. Still didn't make it any easier. And so I went from a company officer in Pearland to a chief officer at Cypress Creek, pretty much overnight. And the coolest thing was, though, and it sounds like I'm chasing money and dollar signs here, and I promise you that's not the case. But when you're a single dad with three kids, you got to do what you got to do. And when I got to the chief officer rank as a district chief down here, it was new. It was brand new to this organization. They had never had shift commanders, district chiefs, battalion chiefs, whatever you want to call them. And so we got to make up whatever the hell we wanted, and we got to emulate things. Like I've said, a few minutes ago, we got to emulate the right things that our leaders have taught us, not do the wrong things that our leaders have taught us, and build a foundation. And we were all young, we were all young in the fire service. And it's just cool to see now, look back and see now and be like, damn, like what the hell were we doing? Like no one knew what the hell we were doing, but we were making it work. And I think that says a lot about the organization and the trust that they have in us.
So how did the transition from battalion chief to training chief come about?
Yeah, so I'd been on shift work, pretty much my entire fire service career. And I'm remarried now, been married for 8 years. And my wife was like, hey, like, you have sleep apnea, you have alcohol problems, you have high blood pressure. Your sleep pattern sucks. You have insomnia. You're taking sleep medicine. Your body hurts when you come home. Like, when are you gonna get off of shift work? And so that kind of planted the seed in my head. And it wasn't until about 3 years that we had an opening at the training chief position. And we had gone through a couple training chiefs through the years, and it just wasn't the right time for me, I don't think. Getting off the truck is one thing, but then getting off shift work and you don't have a shift anymore is a whole nother ball game. And I was like, you know what? Like, I want to be present for my kids. I've put them through a lot. I want to be there to coach my son's football games every weekend. I want to be there to make the birthdays. I want to be there to make Christmases. I want to, I just want to be more present. And at that time, I wasn't really thinking about my own personal health. I was thinking about my kids, and my wife. And so I made that transition. We had a spot open up, and it was one of those things where, anyone else who thought that they were going to put in for it had come to me first and been like, hey man, are you going to put in for this? Because if you put in for it, I'm not going to put in for it. And at that point, I was like, this is the right move for me to make, because people are essentially conceding before even getting into the job process. And I'd be lying if I said that didn't feel good. That felt really good that people wanted me in that position and they trusted me in that position. And since I've taken the 9 to 5 and gone over to the darkest of dark sides, at first it was the chief dark side, now it's the admin chief dark side. You don't get birthday party invites. You don't get golf invites. You don't get work party invites. All that goes away. And it's true what they say. It is lonely as hell at the top. It is lonely. And so you got to have your personal life in order too. I think that's important. And this has propelled me to, get off blood pressure medicine, get off sleeping aids. I've been sober for 2 years now, a little over 2 years now. All of that had transpired because I got off shift work. And I just didn't know that I was slowly, in a sense, injuring myself or hurting myself, because my time was up and I was just hanging on,
Well, first off, man, congratulations and thank
Thank
you
you.
for being transparent and open. 'Cause, at least in my experience, nowadays Firemen type A personalities, they don't shed light on that. They're bravado, macho men, nothing phases me, and nobody really wants to be open like that. So I applaud you for that.
Oh, appreciate it, man. Thank you. Thank you.
The chief of training, definitely in my opinion, I think is a very, very, very important role because that individual sets the tone for how he wants and expects his members of the organization to train to conduct themselves. So training is very important. To me, training is essential for the fire service. But one thing that always baffles me with training is the training budget is always the least amount of money that is allocated for that specific department, which never made sense to me at all.
Right.
So with you taking on that role, what were you envisioning to bring in to Cypress Creek?
We are extremely fortunate to be in the area that we are, along with several neighboring departments. Funding is never really an issue for us. And I recognize that, and that's, one of the many reasons that I will stay in this organization is because we don't have near as bad as money issues as some of the other organizations that I hear about when I travel and go to conferences and all that. It's, training on a shoestring budget is a cliche but proper presentation at most conferences, right? Like usually when you look at a conference schedule, there's training on a shoestring budget. And you'll have, a packed house. I don't ever have to go to that because that just doesn't apply to me. And I'm extremely blessed in that sense. And so, with that being said, it's important to note that those training dollars are allocated to the proper training. And one of the things that I've taken a lot of pride in recently is what I consider alternative training. And that's basically bringing somebody down from the state of New Jersey that's a solar panel expert that was a district chief up there that knows how to fight fires with solar panels on a roof and how that changes operations and the load on the roof and how heavy those things are and what's energized and how to shut off the energy and you just don't think about those things sometimes, and solar energy is seems like it's here to stay, right, wrong, or indifferent. And it's the same with electric vehicles. That's another area where I think you could probably have electric vehicle training every day of the year, and you still wouldn't learn everything about electric vehicles because it's just the atmosphere is changing so quick in that sense. We're having a weather readers class, so we can start reading the weather, and where you're at, the coastal area and hurricanes and all those different weather events, thunderstorms, tornadoes, all those things can be disastrous. And so if we can have people that are aware of what a storm's going to bring or what a storm has the capability of doing, I think that puts a lot of people in the know that need to know. And so, I just try to concentrate a lot on alternative training. I leave a lot of our training to our district chiefs and to our shift training captains. So we have a training captain for each shift that reports directly to me. And we build out a calendar at the beginning of the year that states, what we're going to concentrate on for this month, essentially rainy day training, right? And we have two big initiatives that we've undertaken over the last 2 or 3 years, and that's rope rescue and swift water training. And so we have contracted services that we utilize in order to make sure that our guys are trained up to technician levels on both fronts, swift water and rope rescue. We don't have a dedicated rescue crew. We have a dedicated rescue truck, but the folks on the rescue aren't always necessarily certified in what they need to be certified. So that's what we're working on right now. Yeah.
Okay. And as far as these next couple of questions are my training chief is speaking through me as I ask you, because he always asks me whenever I get a chief of training on, ask him these questions kind of for him so he can hear. So with that being said, What are, and only if you can elaborate, on what your department does, but like as far as does Cypress Creek set aside money for each individual to go to outside training? Because I know like probably most organizations, you have your select few that are gung ho, hey chief, I want to go to this, I want to go to that. And then you have some that don't, that won't go, and then you have some that will only go if you pay them. So can you explain like how does that work with you guys?
Yeah, so for us, in a sense, it's a little bit frustrating because, like you said, we do have those folks that are like, is it paid? Is it overtime? And I'm like, no, dude, I'm paying $4,000 for you to go to this. Like between flight and, meal reimbursements and travel and all that. No, you're not getting paid. You're getting paid in the sense of getting a $4,000 trip out of this thing. You're going to Miami, Florida with your wife. Like, and we don't pay for the wife. They take care of that. But you know what I mean, like, and I'm not going to pull the wool over anyone's eyes here when I say, a lot of times these conferences and these trainings, unless they're, hot training or whatever, but a lot of times these conferences and trainings are mini vacations, right? Like you learn some stuff, you pick some stuff up, but it's more of a recharge. And
Absolutely.
so we don't we pay we pay the individuals for professional development, I guess events, you could say. So we have a Texas Fire Chiefs Academy that puts on a 2-year fire chief program. It's 2 weeks total. You do 1 week 1 year and then another week the next year. And it's everything from budgeting and finance and whatnot. And so we make sure that those that are aspiring to be chief officers in a company officer rank at that point get to go to that. And right now we have most of our officers that are aspiring to be chief officers certified through the Texas Fire Chiefs Academy, and we will pay them for that. We will put them on overtime and pay them for that. Same with the Battalion Chief Academy. If you don't want to go all the way up and you just kind of want to say a district chief, okay, cool. Or you're currently writing up, you have write-up privileges to be a district chief. We'll pay them for that as well. But like if someone's going to FDIC, we will pay the registration, we'll pay the flight, we'll give them meal reimbursement, all that stuff at the government rate, but they're not going to be on the clock for that. And we don't have individual allotments for training. We just don't. I don't have the volume of people that want to go anymore, which is sad, sad to say. But it's the classic. The ones that need the training that should have the outside training are never the ones that are there. And so I when I get to present, during the year and I get to go out and speak at conferences, it's hard because I want to just freak out on everybody in there and say, why the hell aren't you getting to conferences? But they're the ones that are, and so I can't show my frustration in that sense and then have these guys sitting at home. So that's a long answer to the question,
No,
but
it's awesome. I'm sure he appreciates hearing that, and I know I appreciate that last statement because, like for me, one of the things that he changed with our department is, if I want to go to a class, he'll either be like, "All right, I can reimburse you for the amount that you spent." Or I can give you the time. And for me, with my wife, we budget. When we do our budget, it's like, all right, she knows we put a certain amount for conferences that I like to go to. So I always tell them, I don't need the reimbursement. Give me the time. So I don't use my time. You know what I mean? Like, so I'd rather save my time, but I'll pay it on the back end. But I also look at it as an adult. There are some, if you truly want to get good, if you truly want to gain a knowledge, sometimes you have to put aside, well, am I getting paid for it? And I get it. In this day and age, everything's expensive. Trust me, I know. It's stupidly crazy how things are, price-wise. But on the back end, I don't expect the department to pay me to go to something that I want to go to. You know what I mean? And I get it. Everyone's different. Everybody's financials, and we can get in that weeds, but we won't. But my thing is too, as an adult, maybe those individuals need to live within their means, You know what I mean? Like,
I got you.
I'm not trying to throw shade, but it's
It's true.
unfortunate. Like, you know what I mean? Like, be an adult. But I love the fact that you mentioned, and you're transparent that there are some people, within your organization you wish would want to, because trust me, I'd love to go to many, many conferences out there, but I have to find the balance because I don't want to leave my wife holding the bag with the responsibility. So I have to pick and choose which one I can go to.
Absolutely. And that's extremely important. And like I said, we're spoiled. We're spoiled with funding, and it's hard for me to sit here and say, well, we should pay for this and we shouldn't pay for that. We have the means to do that. But at the same time, we talk about, putting your own skin in the game, right? Like that goes a long way, and it shows your leadership. Like, I want this, I want this for myself. I want this for my crew. I want to bring something back for them. And I think when, when you said like, hey, I have to intentionally seek out training, and I have to know which conference I want to go to, how much it's going to cost, what are meals going to cost, and budget for that. Like, man, when I go to a conference and someone comes up to me afterwards and they're like, dude, I paid to be here, and I'm just like, man, like you are a badass. Like to pay your own way, whether you get time or not, or one or the other. Either way, it's money, right? Time is money. And so, when you said that, man, it warms my heart to hear that that's still going on, that people are doing that, because we have people that, they'll do hose training for, an hour and a half and want free lunch out of it. I'm like, what? And that's the firefighter way, right? Like, I don't blame them by any means. That's just firefighters giving an inch and taking a mile. So, but yeah, but at the same time, it's like, man, like this job, a bad, it's kind of cliche, but a bad day in the fire service, someone dies or gets hurt. A bad day at the office, maybe the copy machine was down all day, So, when you're training as an adult, like you said, like you're training for your life, you're training for others' lives, and people's lives are at stake. And so for me, it's like, man, like why would you ever say that there's this stipulation on training? Well, if this doesn't happen, then I'm not going to do it, And I'm like, well, that doesn't quite equate for me. I loved every ounce of training that I got when I was, being trained, and I still do. I'm still a huge proponent of on the job training, formal education, all that good stuff.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm going to switch topics to leadership. Since you are in that leadership role, when you decided to take that position, what did you envision for yourself, and what do you feel like being in a leadership role, what should that individual bring to the table?
I think vulnerability, transparency is a good attribute to have, and I think you've seen a little bit of that already today. But at the same time, you have to be strong. You have to be strong mentally. You have to be able to stick to your guns, hold people to standards, have hard conversations. That's probably number one.
Yes, sir.
People that are afraid of, I won't say afraid of conflict. I think there's a healthy fear of conflict that can be achieved. I don't like conflict personally. My entire organization knows I don't like conflict, but that comes with knowing what's a big deal and what's not a big deal, right? Why aren't you pissed off about this? Well, because I don't care what color the stairs are. I just don't give a shit, And so that's kind of, what I would say is, as far as those attributes being brought to the table, having the hard conversations, which I've gotten pretty good at, are extremely important to me, and something that I've really held paramount in my position. And everyone's like, oh, well, the training chief, what hard conversations do you have to have? Well, you're part of, firing somebody for not performing well, because it's usually performance based, it's training based, it's, and so you got to bring people in and say, hey man, like, you're not cutting the mustard, you're not getting off probation, so you don't get that pay raise. I need to extend your probation 6 months, but then at the same time, being able to understand and being compassionate with where their position is. They might have some crap going on at home that you have no idea about. And so as a leader, you have to transition. You have to stick and move, like I call it. And I think that's extremely important. I'm a big proponent of servant leadership, serving your individuals that you're in charge of, which for me, it's the entire department now. As far as the training goes, making sure that people have the means to train on what they want to train on, within reason, obviously. But I think that that's important too, is taking that role and saying, look, I'm a facilitator now, right? Like, I shouldn't have to, I can, but I shouldn't have to go teach a 3 hour course on XYZ. I should have very capable shift training captains that have a high officer certification level, a high instructor certification level. I should have those individuals conduct the training, and I give those individuals what they need to conduct that training, right? And so finding that balance of, not being in the weeds, but at the same time being in the know, and I think that that's the balance that you walk on when you're a leader.
And one of the things that struck me that you stated was, I mean, no, as humans, we all want to be liked. But there comes a time where when you assume the responsibility of a role, when you take on the role of any sort of chief officer, there are going to be times where you are going to have to be the bad guy. You're not always going to be liked. Not everyone is going to always agree with the decisions you make, but you have to stick with it. But one of the things I think maybe some forget is when you have a situation and you don't address it and you let it slide, for the ones that are all about the mission and for the ones that, I'm just going to be kind of blunt on how I say it. Every organization has those go-to individuals. You have this type of call, I want this crew, I want this person because they're dialed in. And whenever you have those individuals that are what I call dialed in and they see an issue, a deficiency that it's not addressed, not only do you hurt them, but you also hurt the individual that you don't want to address. You know what I mean? And a lot of chief officers have that reactive response of, okay, well, instead of dealing with the situation, everybody gets punished. And that never helps anything. It's like the way I look at it is, if this individual did something wrong, why am I being punished for that? Why aren't you discussing this with that individual? And I love the fact that you brought it up because yes, everybody wants to be liked, but when you are a, especially like the fire chief and anything below, that goes out the window. If there's times to be buddy buddy, and then there's times to, this is the way it's going to be, period, end of story.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, when there's an issue that arrives, especially on a performance-based issue, right? Somebody didn't perform an action that they were supposed to be capable of performing based on their, experience, based on their certification, what have you, right? Based in the time and expectations, whatever. It's important to look at the cause, right? Like the root cause. And it's not always, well, we're going to train until our legs fall off and load 5 inch for, 3 days straight. Like, we're not, that might not be the issue. That might not be the issue there. And so taking a look at what the cause is, what is the root cause? And then understanding that the root cause, they might not even be to blame for their downfalls. Did they have a captain that, checked off their probationary task book and didn't hold them accountable to actually doing the skills? Did they have and there's different fire schools out there, and I get it. And I know some firefighters that have been through a formal fire school that are absolute slugs, and I know some firefighters that have been through an online course that are absolutely amazing. But did that individual go to a fire school that didn't teach them properly? Were they at a bad online fire school that was a check in the box. They did skills, you know, once a month on a weekend and just tried to check them off, because there's people nowadays coming out of fire school saying, I've never touched a K-12 before. I've never vented a roof before, you know? And so whose fault is it? It's not their fault. But then to that point, it comes to being an adult, right? If you don't know something as an adult, whether male or female, I don't give a damn. If you're an adult and you don't know something, you need to speak up and say something. And so ensuring that our people have the platform at any rank to say, look, I am lacking in this area, and not be scared to admit it, that's the tone that I want to set to make sure that those issues are taken care of. And not everybody gets punished. I think that's a knee-jerk reaction a lot of times, right? And you know, do you write somebody up for, you know, not stretching the line correctly? No, it's not a disciplinary action. It's a performance problem, right? And so, yeah, does it need to be documented? Absolutely. But do you need to go through a formal complaint and all this craziness? Most of the time, not, right? Unless it's a systematic problem and it's repetitive and, you know, what have you. There's all kinds of different snowflake circumstances out there that are all different. But for the most part, that's huge, is to be able to create an environment where everybody feels comfortable to have a voice when it comes to training deficiencies. And that's just based on my own experience with, like, what we talked about with Jacob. You know, I felt comfortable with him, and I felt comfortable telling him and being very vulnerable that, hey, I'm about to get into this driver position and I don't know the difference between these two things. And I want others to have those conversations, those tough conversations.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. And I think it all too also it goes back to training scars. You know, back in the day when I was growing up in the fire service, it was if I was being taught something, for some reason, a lot of the instructors felt like yelling was the thing to do. And it's that now I am not an instructor, but every once in a while I will help teach as a as what I call an extra set of hands to students on certain topics that I feel I sign up for topics that I feel like I'm pretty okay with, pretty good at. So like whenever I see an individual that isn't getting it, I don't belittle them. I don't like yell at them because to me, when I'm being yelled at, I tune you out. I shut down. I'm not hearing anything that you're saying. So like I'll one-on-one kind of privately discuss, hey, you having any issues? Let me show you some tips and tricks. Now there are times where you are going to have to get stern, but I don't like instructors that because they're an instructor, they feel like they're inferior over that person. And it's like, oh, well, you do this wrong, I'm gonna call you out in front of everybody. I'm gonna yell at you. Like that's not the way students learn nowadays. Nobody wants to be belittled. So I love the fact that you mentioned that.
I feel like when instructors get to the, and I teach at the college as well. I'm one of the fire school instructors at the local college down the street. I feel like when instructors get to the point, or, you know, just any instructor, whether it's at the fire department or at the fire school or what have you, when you get to the point where you're screaming at somebody, post-evolution based on their performance, you have really limited your ability to communicate with them, but you've also ran out of tools to be able to address the situation. And so now you're just frustrated and you're screaming and you're taking it out on that kid or that person. And that to me just doesn't fly with me either. I'm not a big hoop and holler guy. I like to bring a little bit of a presence there, that allows for conversation and questions. My big thing is at the fire school, not to get off on a different tangent, but my big thing is after every evolution, if I have the availability, which I usually do, to finish up a little bit quicker than the other groups before we rotate, I always ask them, do you have any questions about what we just went over tonight? Right? And that's pretty basic. A lot of instructors do that. But then understanding that they're in fire school and they probably have a million other questions that have nothing to do with this evolution, saying, do you have any other questions about the fire service and just in general? You know, and you know, the first hand goes up and they say something and everyone else laughs. And I'm like, do you know the answer to this? And then they don't laugh anymore, right? Because they're like, I was wondering the same thing. But yeah, it was a funny question. So, I just got done on Wednesday. I was out at the Fire Academy. I helped teach the night class out there. And one of the students asked me in the classroom before we went out to do drills. He said, "Hey, can you talk to the class about benefits in the fire service and shift schedules and retirement? Can you talk about those things to the class? Because we all have questions about them." I was like, "Yeah, absolutely, man." And every time they ask me to tell them about something, it warms my heart because I feel like I've opened that dialogue up. I've had the ability now to communicate to them, like, whatever questions you have beyond just the Fire Academy stuff, because there's so much more to the fire service, right? Let me know, and I'll talk to you till I'm blue in the face about them. And so it makes me feel good to have that. So you're exactly right. Screaming at cadets and recruits, and fellow firefighters, your peers, is a no-go for me for sure. And I don't think we have any of that going on in our organization. And if we do, and someone's listening to this, quit doing that stuff because it'll piss me off.
I mean, it's time and place. If you see somebody that's doing something that's very unsafe, right there, yes, correct it right there. But it's like, I don't understand individuals that go around, and it's like, is it because you have that some individual has given you the power and you feel like, hey, this is how I'm going to do it? But I think it all comes down to how they were taught. It's just a cycle. So I know the way I was taught, it was do as you say, quiet, only ask questions when we ask you. Like, I get it. Back then, that's what I did. But coming up now, the people that especially with the individuals we are hiring 18, 19, 21-year-olds with no life experience per se. And they're gonna have questions. And so I don't look at them as, oh, that's dumb. How do you not know that? Because when I was growing up in the fire service, I didn't know anything about chainsaws. And so I was taught. So I just like you, I can't understand, and I really don't like people that do that because it's like, do you feel good when you get to do that to people? Does it make you feel a certain way? And for some it does, but I think those individuals, if you are training people like that, I think maybe you should reevaluate that. And or if whoever is in charge of that, if you know that that's how that person is, maybe you should have a talk. Because like that's just because at the end of the day, I've had conversations with some of our newest people in the fire service in general. They'll be like one-on-one, hey, I wish that this person instructed like you because I don't like how they talk. And I'll tell them like I don't like how they do it either. It's dumb, but yeah. So anyways.
No, I hear you. All three of my shift training captains are very soft-spoken. All three of them. And it's kind of, emulates what I am. Kind of a laissez-faire, laid back instructor. And I think that that shows a lot of confidence. When other people look at it and like, man, they're not screaming, but they know their shit. Like it just exudes this confidence. And so I think when instructors get hyped up or company officers get hyped up to the point of their screaming, it discredits their knowledge and their experience because you're not concentrated on, what's being said. You're concentrated on how it's being said to you. And that is where you lose the whole student instructor relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to I want to get to the mental wellness side, but I also want you to talk about the an incident you had back in 2015, because I hear it a lot where like I train the way I train or I go to these classes and you'll have some individuals be like, why are you taking that? That's never gonna happen here. But this job, it's just a matter of time. Wherever you're at in the country, it doesn't matter. So especially when you're in an area where, like, I'm sure you are staff dependent, where you have resources around you that can get there pretty quick. But for an individual that lives out in the middle of nowhere, your mutual aid response is 15 minutes away. Like, you need to kind of be on your game. So I want you to talk about the incident you had in 2015.
I was full time at Pearland at that time. I think I was actually still, I was still driving Jacob at the time. And I was working my part time job at Cypress Creek, where I'm a full time firefighter now. And it was 6:53 or 5:53, and we get off at 6 p.m. And the volunteers came in and took over in the evenings. And I heard the gong go off and walked out to the truck, and I start hearing that we're going to be a mutual aid resource for our neighboring department. And I would probably say 75% of the time you get turned around. It's hey, we got it, no big deal, right? And some of that comes with like bravado, right? Like, we don't need help from the outside, we're good. But that didn't happen. And so we made the right hand turn on a pretty major thoroughfare, and that's where I saw the column from the apartment complex. This was a apartment complex that was had been refaced many times, refurbished, whatever term you want to use, but it was built in the 70s. It was balloon frame construction from the floor to the attic. No fire stops in the attic whatsoever. So this thing was getting it. It was really windy that day too. I remember that as well. And we showed up, and I had probably close to 50, 55 years of experience on the truck with me between everybody there. And I felt really confident. I'm like, damn, this is cool. Like, I have the right crew. Because as when you work a part-time or a volunteer department, you don't know who you're going to get
That's
sometimes.
right.
And
That's right.
sometimes you're in the truck and you're just like, I hope
Shit.
that we get disregarded, right?
Yeah.
And even then, I'm still worried. I don't even know if we can handle a disregard. But yeah, so I felt confident about it. We got out of the truck. We were in engine 24. I had a 26 placard on my helmet because that was our duty crew placard. Every duty crew member had a 26 for whatever reason. And then my guy knew the my firefighter in the back knew the district chief that was running the call, the IC. So he went to report to the IC for me. I was riding lieutenant, and he reported to him as engine 25. So now we have engine 24 on scene. I have a 26 placard on my helmet, and we reported to IC as engine 25. So clearly, that ended up not being an issue, but just, another cog in the wheel of
Right.
a dysfunctional beginning. Our mutual aid organization was kicking ass. They normally do. Great department. I have nothing bad to say about them. This wasn't on them. We got sent to the Charlie side of the structure. It was a mirrored Alpha and Charlie side as far as the stairwells going up. It was a three-story apartment complex, and we were tasked to go to the third division, get up in the ceiling, and help the folks on the Alpha side cut off the fire. So we were essentially going to meet them. I know people can't see my hands right now, but we were going to meet them and pinch off the fire in the attic and stop it from spreading for the through the rest of the building. me and my buddy, he was riding district chief at the time. He showed up, and I had tasked out my other firefighters with ventilation. And so they were working on getting ladders and everything. And me and my buddy, we stretched this line, and we did an apartment lay. We went from a 2.5 to a gated Y to an inch 3/4. We started working our inch 3/4 up the stairwell, the exterior stairwell. And I was always taught, I don't know how this is across the nation, but I was always taught if stuff gets bad inside an apartment fire, you can bail out to the stairwell, and that's kind of your safe haven, and get back out or what have you. And so I felt safe inherently. I felt safe in the stairwell, and we were stretching line, and our nozzle man was up, and he was almost all the way to the third division to open the door up there. And I heard like a crack, or I heard something kind of creak or fall, like a boom. And before I knew it, the stairwell above us, all three of the stairwells came down on top of us. And this was a concrete stairs with steel I-beams that ran the length of the floors. And so it was pretty heavy. It wasn't, just some wood stairs that someone threw in there. It was built for sure. And so when we fell, I ended up falling with my hand underneath my body, my right hand underneath my body. My left hand was outstretched. And if anyone's ever been like held down by their dad or by somebody, when you were a kid and you felt like you couldn't get up no matter how much strength you had as a kid, that's what I likened it to. Your first instinct is to pop up. Your first instinct is to get out of there. That's just a basic primal human instinct. And I tried and I couldn't. I had about an inch clearance between my air pack and the stairs on top of me. My left hand was outstretched, and I think that was there was a bigger plan there because my buddy was in front of me and he was on the landing. And the other landing came down on top of him and it folded him like a pretzel. I mean, it was bad. He was holding up the weight of the landing in the stairwell with the top of his SCBA bottle and the brim of his helmet, the back brim of his helmet. So he was folded up with his head in between his knees. And he's a big guy. He's big guy like me. And he kept passing out. He kept it was bad. I could go on and on about the details about that, but needless to say, there was a lot of questioning of life. There was a lot of, this is it. This is how I'm going to go. Tell my wife that I love her. Tell my kids. All that. And I'm like, man, like there's no way that this is how this is gonna end, My left hand was outstretched and I could touch his right leg and right knee. And he also kept yelling that his legs were burning, his legs were on fire. And when he fell, he sat on a good amount of fire and embers and whatnot, and they were starting to get in through his gear. So I just swept my left hand like hell and tried to sweep out anything I could from the right side of his body. The left side I couldn't get to. And so three Mayday calls went out. Two Mayday calls from a firefighter that rode down the stairwell on top of the collapse. And then one Mayday call from the sector chief that was on the backside, on the Charlie side. And we got extricated, I would probably say within 3 to 4 minutes. You sit in silence for 3 to 4 minutes. That's a long ass time. And not that it was silent, but just to put a time perspective on it. And that was wild to me. They ended up extracting me. I told them that I wasn't letting go of my buddy's leg until they ensured me that they were going to get him out too. And they said, yeah, we've uncovered everything. We're pulling him out with you. And so by the time I got down the stairs, I knew that my buddy was coming down as well. And it's one of those things that I look back on, and all through fire school, I went through fire school with him. I knew his kids, knew his wife. I mean, we were really good buddies. And all through fire school, we had always talked crap about, how we were gonna die together and how we were gonna save each other if it ever came down to it, and how we were gonna go out valiantly and all this stuff. And then this happened, and in a sense, we got to prove it, And I always joke with him, and I'm like, "Well, I didn't have a choice but to stay by your side, because if I did, I would have been gone." I always joke with him though, but in all seriousness, we got a chance to kind of prove our devotion to one another, and it all came full circle, and that was super amazing to me. And so, every March 27th, I get a text message from Jacob that tells me, hey man, I'm glad you're still with us, and I'll forget, and he will text me, and I'm like, oh yeah, today's the day that we almost died. Ended up tearing my ACL, MCL, PCL, meniscus. Took some good hits on the back of my head, which might have straightened some things out, I don't know. Yeah, got loaded up in the ambulance and shot across the street to the hospital. There was smoke from the apartment complex in the hospital parking lot. I remember pulling up, and yeah, from that point forward, man, it was a roller coaster ride for sure. And a good segue into the mental health side of things.
But your buddy did he make a full recovery?
He did make a full recovery, just because of the platform that we're on right now. I don't want to share exactly what led to him leaving the fire service, but
Okay.
he had some major mental blocks that prevented him from coming back. And essentially, he retired from the fire service a lot earlier than what he had anticipated, and that was really sad to see. But I understood it.
Understood. Understood. And like you said, with that being said, that's another topic you want to talk about, mental wellness side.
Yeah. And before that, I was in the midst of a divorce, and I talked about that a little bit earlier. And three small kids, and anytime you're going through major life changes like that, it's a lot of compound stressors that get the best of people. And this was another stressor. I was out away from the firehouse. I was out away from essentially the thing that kept me most sober and most grounded. And this is one thing that I want to implore leaders, and not leaders in the sense of rank, but leaders in the sense of being a good leader in the fire service, whatever your rank is. There are firefighters right now that show up to work, and the only reason that they're sober is because they're at work. And there are firefighters right now that are showing up not sober to work. Substance abuse in the fire service is extreme. Extreme. And I'm not here to preach on any kind of and make people feel bad. That's not what I'm here for, but I lived it. I lived it for a long time, and it wasn't until a couple years ago when I got fully clean and fully sober that I could really see where the pitfalls were. And this injury was one of them. I was addicted to pain pills. I was left to my own devices. I was an absent father to my three children, because I felt guilty for me and their mom going through a divorce. And every time I saw them, it reminded me of how bad I felt. And so to get away from that, I just avoided it. I avoided the issue in itself, the issue being my kids, which still hurts my heart to say. But I avoided it, to the next level with pills and alcohol. And poor social relationships. I bought into what society wants me to do, and that's to go out and party and celebrate being divorced and drink and, be rowdy and all these things, and it doesn't have to be like that, and it shouldn't be like that. To me, divorce isn't something that should be celebrated, in a sense. And I think that the fire service and just first responder organizations in general don't do a very good job at communicating that. It's, oh yeah, let's go get effed up because John's got divorced now. His divorce is final. Let's go have a divorce party. And I'm like, man, why are we celebrating it? Like, what is going on here? And it just hurts my heart. Maybe that's a personal thing, but just experiencing that, it was rough. And that led me down a very rough path of about 7 or 8 months. And like most addicts, I put a time frame on it. I was like, look, 8 months from now, when I get back on the truck, I'm going to stop all this. I'm going to stop the pills. I'm going to be sober. I'm going to get back in my kids' lives, but I'm just going to do this for 8 months, and I'm going to party my ass off. And that's never the case. I would show up to work. I'd show up to work. I'd be passed out on the recliner for pass down. The off-going officer would talk to me and tell me, hey, this is what we did yesterday. These are the tools that are having issues. This is the PR schedule for today. And I would be passed out. I wouldn't even realize what he was saying. And my crew is the reason that I was able to even halfway function. And I'd show up to work drunk. I was homeless for a little bit. I lived out of my truck or fire stations. I would tell the rookie to come knock on my window when shift change was the night before. I'd say, hey, I'm gonna go out tonight and I'll be in the parking lot. And so that meant that I drove drunk to the firehouse. And yeah, there's so much going on in that time. And probably the most impactful thing that I share with people is a time that I was scheduled to promote to lieutenant finally. I had ridden up as a lieutenant for close to 18 months, and finally a spot became available where they were going to promote me. And I went out the night before, and the promotion was scheduled for a Saturday, and this was a Friday night. I went out the night before, and I don't know why I wanted to party the night before promotion. Usually it's like after you get
After,
promoted, but my addict mind just didn't click like that. And so I went out to Midtown Houston, effectively got completely annihilated by myself because everyone else was like, "No, dude, we're gonna go out and drink Saturday night, not Friday night." I'm like, "Well, I'm doing both nights." And I had convinced my ex-wife to take my three kids to my promotional ceremony in the morning, so my kids could pin my badge on, because I think that was spe I thought that would be special for me. And so I convinced her to show up at 9 o'clock in the morning at headquarters in Pearland, and I had overslept, and I missed my own promotion. And I think it was either just me or maybe there was one other person getting promoted. So it wasn't like there was 30 people getting promoted and we're just missing one of them. It's like, no, it's noticeable. And I woke up and I had a bunch of missed calls and missed text messages. I felt like shit immediately. Just started getting emotional about what had just transpired. And I called one of the chief officers at the time that I was close with, and he told me that he was going to cover for me. And I wish he told me that I was going to get fired. I wish that would have happened. I wish that I would have been held accountable for what I was doing and the road that I was going down. But in the fire service, we have this innate ability to protect at all costs our crew members and our personnel. And I think there's a time and place for that as well. I think it's important, but I also think it's important to hold people accountable, and teach them something that will be fruitful in their life, not to allow them to continue to self-destruct. And I don't blame, I've got to present this among many other things, but I've got to present this to some of my former crew members at conferences, and they've come up to me and been like, "Dude, I am so sorry. I am so sorry that we didn't say something and we didn't report it and we didn't get you the help that you needed." But in the fire service back then, that wasn't happening. That wasn't normal,
That's it. Yep.
And so to deal with it, it was like, "Oh, we're the Brotherhood. LT, get in the back of the ambulance. We'll drop two lines in you, and we'll rehydrate you, and then just go take a nap." And that's what my rookies saw. That's what my subordinates saw, was this officer coming in completely either drunk or hungover, and getting IVs dropped in his arms, and then getting told to go sleep it off. And that's how we would start our shifts. And it was a very rocky road and dark time for me. And I think finding my now wife was a huge element. My faith is a huge element of this as well. And my friend circle, I had to change a lot of things. I mean, even as minute as it's just the music I listen to is completely different now. The way I carry myself, my actions are different. It had to have been a life change. And there's actually something that comes from this. It's called post-traumatic growth. It's called PTG. And I'm not sure if you or any of your listeners have heard of it before, but post-traumatic growth is the innate ability to grow back stronger. You have the ability, when you go through something, to come back stronger because of that. And it's almost like a superpower, but you have to treat it as such. You have to embrace it And that's something that I've learned and I've tried to emulate when I do get to speak at conferences, is to make sure that everyone knows, just because you're down and out right now, or you were down and out in the past, or you have a PTSD diagnosis, it's not a death sentence. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to have that for the rest of your life. You can change your ways, and you can do anything if you put your mind to it, you know, and I'm living proof. And I got to hold on to my job for reasons that I shouldn't have been able to hold on to my job.
Understood.
But the lesson that that's taught me is, even then, I still have this I guess thankfulness, or this gratitude towards the fire service, that I'm still allowed to be in the positions that I'm in. And so now I try to maximize that position. So beyond the training side of things, I'm also the wellness director for our department. I help develop our mental wellness plan, our mental wellness resources, our clinicians, our chaplains, our peer support group. I had a hand in all of that because of what my past was. And so when I talk about post-traumatic growth, that's exactly what I mean. Taking your struggles in the past, amplifying them, and then fixing them on the grand scale and affecting other people's lives.
No, I totally get it. First off, thank you. Thank you for that. That's, like I said, a good number of people won't share their struggles, their dark times, bad times, however you want to look at it. And I truly believe too, what doesn't help, and this has taken me, like, I used to not see it, but as I've gotten older, I see it now. Social media tends to give people a false sense of reality. People see. I'm trying to say, all right. So if somebody has something that you don't have, some people take it as like, damn, I wish I have what that person has. But I look at it as there's a context to it. You don't know that that person worked their ass off to get it. The person's up at 4 or 5 a.m. And this re this I see, this goes with everything.
Sure.
Life, health, financials. Like, there are some people that are given things. Totally, they're born with the money. But then there are people that their parents, they saw how their parents worked and their parents struggled, but their parents persevered so that they have come to terms with that. And so they never want to be that way. So
Absolutely.
I say all that to say, people tend to see things on social media, but individuals are only going to show you the things that they want to show you. You know, you have these people that are called influencers now. They have a huge following. So I don't know if they make money or not, but some of them make money, but all they show, some of them, all they show and all you see are the good things. You never see the bad side of things. You know what I mean? And you know, we have like what it's called trending. Like, things are trending. Like, one thing I notice the fire service does, and I really hope I don't rub people the wrong way, but like, I'll see, like, for the fire service, December or whatever month, there's a certain thing that they want you to do. And it's positive, don't get me wrong, but we are wiring ourselves where it's like, oh, it's this month. Said person said, I have to do this. I'm going to go along to do. Like, I start noticing I would do it. And then it's like, why am I letting social media or an influencer or whoever it is, like, tell me I need to do this because of a certain month? Like, it just doesn't make sense, you know? And so, like, you know, I look at it like fitness wise. If you have a goal in mind, there's something that you want to do, go out and do it. Like, and I understand it's easier said than done, but if you truly want to change, whether it's financials, fitness, whatever the case may be, go out and do it. Like, that's the way my parents raised me. Nothing's handed to you. Like, my parents didn't hand me shit. It was like, oh, you want something? Go get a job. And then, you know what I mean? But like, nowadays it's different, but like, I'm raising my daughter Like if you want something, girl, you're gonna have to work at it. Like she wants to, Dad, I want to learn how to dribble a basketball. Okay, I'm gonna show you. Listen, you're not gonna get it the first time. It's gonna take you multiple times, and she'll get frustrated. She'll start crying, and I'm like, hey, girl, listen, I'm here. I can wipe your tears, but life's not gonna do that.
Yeah, that's
Like you
right.
gotta hold your own.
That's right.
And so, like, I appreciate the fact that you share that because, yeah. That's what the fire service does. Like we are here for each other. But one thing that you hit on, I wish that organizations would maybe think about. Granted, there are things that are non-negotiables when it comes to your like the conduct of the employee.
Sure.
But when it comes to things like drinking and substance abuse, just remember if you were in that position, and then whenever I say that, you hear people go, well, I'll never get in that position. Listen, you don't know what life's going to throw at you. You don't know what you're going to have to do.
That's right.
So, like, I wish that maybe before we would go, hey, you're terminated. Maybe the employer goes, hey, hold on. Let's look at this person's track record. If they've never been like, if they've never been in situations, let's find out what the issue is. Let's give them a second chance. Throwing them out, you know. So-called in the garbage and then moving on isn't always the right thing to do. And I get it. There are different like avenues, like I said, non-negotiables. But like I hate whenever we dismiss a 15, 20-year employee who's been stellar, who's been great at the job over an infraction where it's like, well, let's kind of correct the infraction instead of throwing it out. You know what I mean?
Is it a trend? Is it something? And our program allows free clinician appointments. That was my big thing, is removing the hurdles from people seeking help if they want it. And I've always told people, especially officers, if I hear you talking bad about the mental health program, I will write your ass up, and you probably get pretty close to being fired, because at that point you're impeding someone's health and safety. And that, I know everyone's like, oh man, that's rough, that's harsh. I've had a lot of good success with communicating that to people, understanding that. And we'll go back to even social media, and you hit on that. My first step to growth and recovery was getting off of social media. That was my first step. And I, quite frankly, I couldn't handle social media. I was a stupid ass guy that was out there flirting with all these women and just being stupid with it, first of all. Second of all, I would use social media to do exactly what you said. When I was in my deepest, darkest struggles, I was in the best shape of my life. I have a picture that I show during my presentations, and you wouldn't even recognize me. That's how good a shape I was in. And I was the sickest I had ever been in my life. And I try to put that in perspective for people. I was the guy that would take his three kids, once a month, maybe on a Sunday, and go to church and take a picture of them in front of the church, put them in Sunday school, go sit in the back, and then leave and just continue on with my crappy behavior. But I got that picture, and I got to put it on Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and all these things. And everyone got to see that, man, this guy's in shape. This guy, has a good job. This guy takes his kids to church, like all this crazy shit. But at the end of the day, I was killing myself. I was killing myself, and I was hiding it. And I got very good at hiding it. A lot of addicts are very good at hiding it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you want to be held accountable. Like, I didn't know I wanted to be held accountable, but I wanted to be held accountable. I wanted someone to step in, and they were like, I know it's cliche, but cries for help. Like, those are so prevalent to me now. And again, I'm thankful that that happened. I'm thankful that I've been able to transition to the growth side. And now I can tell people, look, dude, like, your career's not over. Your life is not over. I've promoted three times over since all of this addiction. Like, I've found an amazing lifestyle that I live now. Like, all of these things are still possible. Nothing's written in stone. right? And I think we can all agree that life is really written in sand, right? I mean, it can get erased and rewritten as many times as you want it to. And like you said, opportunity, taking chances, understanding that, hey, if I want something, I got to go get it. You know, I listen to David Goggins a lot. And I mean, that guy, right, wrong, or indifferent, people have all kinds of different opinions. But the one thing he says is, if you want something, you have to go get it, you know? And that just, that, and he says it a million different ways. And I'm paraphrasing. But every time he says that, I'm like, man, that is so damn motivating. That is so damn motivating.
I mean, it's, and I don't know if it's a, because it's a 2024 thing, but like you said, some people may not like the way he pres, but it's the way I was brought up. Like my dad's like, oh, you like that? Yeah, that's real nice, right? You know how you get those real nice things? You go out and get it. Meaning, go to school, learn. We take you, we put you to put you in school to learn, not make all these friends. Like, and back then, I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But now, especially being a parent, like all the things my parents would do and tell me, it's like, fuck, I get it now. Like they weren't being dick to me. You know what I mean? Like they were trying to set me right. So like I said, Chief, I appreciate it. And I don't want people to take it out of context. Like there are very positive things, very positive trends that the fire service does, or individuals who have a platform within the fire service that they do. But I want people, like, I just don't want people to don't rely on, okay, December, this is the only time I have to do this. No, go out throughout the year and work on whatever skill it is that you need to work on. You don't need a specific time period
Oh
within the
man.
year that you have to
Yes.
do it. That's what I'm trying to get people to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the day that my full recovery started, I'll remember because I was at a fire conference. It wasn't on New Year's, it wasn't on my birthday, it wasn't, on Christmas, it wasn't Thanksgiving. It wasn't like a day that I set out that I'm like, okay, on 3/3/23, I'm going to do something to change my life. I saw a need and I took the opportunity to change. And that was completely what I thought at the time, not possible. Not possible. Like, there's no way I can never, ever drink alcohol ever again. There's no way. But then I was like, okay, we're just going to take it one day at a time. And everyone always asked me, they're like, hey man, because I still hang out with the guys, and I still go on river trips with, different guys from work and all this stuff. How long are you going to be sober? Like, is this a forever thing? And I'm like, this is something that I will assess every morning when I wake up. And when I can find the benefits to drinking, then I'll start again. And I still have yet to come up with a single benefit to drinking alcohol for myself, right? I don't judge other people, but for myself, I don't have any positives that come from it. Zero. And that's one of the things that I've taken control of, which has been nice. And like you said, just taking control of it, seeing something, seeing where you want to be, and seizing that, and understanding, the social media and the get it now. If your phone takes more than 3 seconds to load a web page, everyone's freaking out, right? And is anyone else's internet down? Oh, never mind, it just loaded, and so I don't know. It's just we're in a different age and time. And again, for me, if you really want to get serious about recovery and seizing opportunity and all that stuff, man, how much time are you wasting on social media? How much time are you wasting on scrolling upwards and downwards and sideways and everything like that? And I don't know. It's just one of those things, man, that I inherently just stopped doing, and it proved itself in dividends.
Awesome. Awesome. Love the message, Chief. I always like to ask the guests at the end of the interview, where would you like to see yourself before you retire out of the fire service? And right now you're currently a division chief of training. Is there maybe any notion of before you retire out, you'd like to see yourself as the actual top dog fire chief anywhere, or is it wherever life leads you?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, I always tell people like I'd be a good number two. And that's kind of where my mindset is right now, and that just inherently is the next promotional spot, I guess. I've put in for a few fire chief positions just to get to what the process get through what the process is. Never realistically thinking about leaving my organization, because I love it. I love it so much. I love the people I work with and the quirks that they all have and the arguments we get in and the pay and the budgeting. Like I love everything about where I'm at. And so I'm going to say that based on my faith, I'm going to go wherever life takes me, and I'm going to lean into that. And life has put me on a roller coaster. I think most people live life on a roller coaster, the ups and downs. But I can say now, I feel like I've been riding it up for a long time, and it doesn't comes with bumps and bruises, of course, but I trust in what my higher power has in store for me.
Understood. Understood. With that being said, Chief, I want to say thank you. First off, I want to say thank you to Chief Jacob Johnson for introducing me to you
Yeah,
and
he's a good dude.
for you coming on and accepting this and being open, like I said, vulnerable, because I'm a realist. A lot of people are throwing out facades out there, man. Like
Yep.
people, you think, hey, this person's got it all and they are struggling. You don't know what's going on, and they put on a show. So the
That's
fact that
right.
you came on here, you were very transparent, open. I appreciate it. I appreciate Chief Johnson for getting me in contact with you, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this. It really means a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And I appreciate that. Also, one thing that's been bugging me this whole time, I believe I misspoke earlier when I said 11,000. I meant 1,100. So
Oh, okay.
we're not Philly by any means. So, but no, also, if anyone wants to get a hold of me, just make sure that they have the means to do that, especially on the wellness side of things. I have a nonprofit called Garden Grounds Ranch. I also have a for-profit where we go around and we assist in mental wellness program builds, and that's called Ironclad Wellness. Someone wants to get a hold of me. It's jason@ironcladwellness.com, and we'll get you taken care of. And I'm looking forward to talking to more people about it and getting people the help that they might need.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate
Absolutely.
you putting that out there. That way, anybody that's out there that needs, I mean, because we all need assistance in something. Like, to me, there's no perfect person out there. The only perfect person out there died for us, and I
Right.
don't go down that because I am not a trying to figure out how to say this. Like, I believe in a higher power. I'm a little different with my experiences of it, but I truly believe like we all have a maker and we are all on borrowed time. So
Absolutely.
with that being said, like I said, Chief, I appreciate you coming on and
Yeah.
talking shop. This has been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.